Good morning, everyone. I don't often get applauded before the sermon, let me say. Even less often after. It's very nice to be back with you again. And we will work our way through the communion. Now, I've never done it this way before, and we'll see how we go. But the Lord will understand. Hundreds of thousands of people were packed into Jerusalem for a religious festival. We aren't sure which one it was, but scholars tell us it was one of the big three. I'm just waiting for Emma to find the slide. We had it there for a moment. Ah, there we go. Biblical scholars tell us it was one of the big three, the Passover, the Feast of Tabernacles, or Pentecost. And the big three meant that the joint was really jumping. Every Jewish person was expected to attend these festivals at least once in his or her life, and so people came from everywhere. That may have actually been why Jesus came to town. For a week or two, the temple was the focal point of cultural and religious life, just like Grand Final week in Melbourne, or on a normal year, the Aussie Open. All the alleyways, pathways, and streets leading to the temple were crowded with pilgrims or street sellers. While all this religious, fervent, cultural activity was taking place up here, the ordinary life of the city continued, sometimes hidden away, but very real. Out the back of the temple, away from the main thoroughfare and the al fresco dining areas, was a narrow alley which joined the temple to a gate called the Sheep Gate. This gate was used as an access route for the animals which were to be sacrificed at the temple for Passover. It allowed the animals to be kept outside the crowded city and temple areas, herded up this narrow street directly into the temple. Needless to say, this place was not the centre of the city's religious life. Down by the Sheep Gate was an underground bathhouse. It consisted of a large pool divided into two. It was trapezium-shaped, approximately 100 metres long and 50 to 65 metres wide, with colonnaded porticos all around it. It was replenished by an intermittent spring of water, which caused the pool to bubble up occasionally. Many believed that the bubbling was actually an angel troubling the waters, and the tradition developed that the first person into the water after the bubble started would be healed of any disease or ailment that they had. Now, this was the days before universal healthcare. So any story like this was sure to have one major effect. Many sick, lame, blind, and infirm in the city made their way to this pool. Every day, not just at festival time, there was a pilgrimage of another kind, not to the temple, but to this miserable place. Although it might have been quite flash once, by this time it had seen better days. The Sunday school pictures I remember made it look something like the pool at a luxury resort, with its clean white tiles and all the sick people lined up in neat rows, waiting patiently and in an orderly fashion for their turn. Not so. Think about the stench in the enclosed dark space. All manners of sickness and disability gathered together. And then, when the waters bubble up, there would be a stumbling stampede in the direction of the pool. I shudder when I think of the wet, bedraggled mass of humanity struggling to get out of the water, wondering who had been the lucky one to hit the water first. Here is a picture of two levels of human existence. Up here on the surface, the frenzied religious and cultural activity, celebration and ritual, and other various ways people seek to make contact with God and express their belief. Down below the surface, hidden out the back, we find deep need, great pain, and mess not being addressed by all the activity up here. But the good news is, Jesus was there. He had left the activity up top and made his way to be with these people in the middle of the dirt and the pain and the vain hopes. This was good news for that motley group of needy people, but it is good news for me today and perhaps for you as well. I know all about that. I am well known for frenzied religious activity. Many Baptist people are. Some of it is very good, but it does not always address the deep pain below the surface within me. Sometimes I actually use that frenzied religious activity to avoid the deep needs and pain within me. The real questions of life and faith, the feelings of doubt and anger and hurt caused by other people, the inability to cope, which I may not wish to own. And it's easier to engage up here. The good news is that while we may seek to express our faith, make contact with God up here, Jesus comes to us down here. And he comes with acceptance and grace. So the good news from Jesus comes first as presence. He comes to be with us even when it's uncomfortable and difficult. He also comes as an invitation to move forward and change. Otherwise, offering us a new beginning. John seems to imply that Jesus knew this man lying on his poor man's mat in the middle of the squalor. And we assume that he knew he'd been ill for a long time. And yet he asks him, "Do you want to get better?" Seemed like a silly question to me. I can imagine him saying, "No, I come here because I like it." The good news always comes to us as an invitation, not a command. And it is not as silly as it sounds, because ultimately the choices to change, move, grow must be ours. That choice brings new experiences, a sense of the unknown, and responsibility. It might be awful here, but at least I know what it's like. I can imagine this by 38 years. I worked it out. It could have been, if he'd gone every day, take off 4 weeks for annual leave, bit of sick leave, about 10,000 times he may have gone to this place. Why would Jesus ask him, "Do you want to get better?" I imagine he could say, "It might be awful here, but at least I know what it's like. I know what to expect. No thanks. Who knows what I might be asked to do if I can walk? It might be better to stay like this." There are people like that. And let me say, there are churches like that. The good news comes to us as an invitation, not conscription. I don't have the time. I'm too busy with what's going on up there. It may not be perfect, but it's all I've got. The man says to Jesus, there's no one here to put me in the water when it bubbles up. I get lost in the stampede. Someone always beats me to it. Do you want to get better? Forget the excuses. Do you want to get better? Take up your pallet and walk, was the instruction. Now, I imagine this is a lot easier said than done. A person who hasn't walked properly for 38 years would have to learn a few things about standing, then walking, and then picking up and carrying. It can be quite unsettling, if not frightening, when the gospel comes to us. We don't know what lies ahead. When the Hebrew slaves, running from slavery in Egypt, found themselves with the Red Sea ahead of them and the powerful Egyptian army behind them, the word came from God, tell the people to move forward. An angel moved behind to protect them, which was one thing, but I still bet that first step into the Red Sea could have been very difficult. The good news comes firstly as presence and acceptance, and then as an invitation to change. But it's not the stuff up here on the surface that needs to change. It's the stuff down here. Jesus doesn't meet us up there. He meets us down here. When Jesus asks us if we want to get better, he is addressing us down here, not up on the surface. And it's not only individuals. When he comes to Brighton Baptist Church, after what I understand has been a turbulent period in its life, he asks, do you want to get better? He's not addressing us on the surface. He's addressing us down here. You know, I need to have just a sip of water. When people first visit a church with a view to making it their spiritual home, they largely respond to their first impressions. The initial impact helps them make their choice to stay, come again, or look elsewhere. There's usually a lot of attention given in churches to the way newcomers are welcomed. And I must say, the three occasions I've been here recently, the welcome has been warm and wonderful. It's only after they've been in the church for a while that they discover more about it. In every church, there are unseen factors that make up the culture of the congregation. Edgar Schein has used the image of an iceberg to represent the culture of a congregation or an organisation, which can easily be applied to a church. Above the surface, I hope you can see that, is the tip of the iceberg. Above the surface, there are what he calls the rituals and the artifacts, the visible aspects of the church. The rituals may include the welcome you get, the worship services, including the music, the regular programs and activities, especially the kids program, the friendliness at the after-church coffee, and for some people, are women involved in leadership? The artifacts may include the buildings and the surroundings, the pictures, the plaques or banners that adorn the buildings, the signage, the logo, the church bulletin, and the church directory. That is the tip of the iceberg. On the surface, there are what Shane calls the explicit values. These reveal the goals and aspirations of the church and may include the church constitution, a strategic plan if you have one, the leadership structure, and a membership covenant if you have one. These things tell us what the church holds dear and what they have committed themselves to achieve. Under the surface, where 90% of the iceberg lives, is a large part of the congregational culture that we do not see at first. These are the unspoken rules and norms that superimpose themselves upon church life and may include such things as the way conflict is managed or avoided, the role and/or expectations of the pastor, the pastor's spouse or children, the way information is shared, the informal decision-making processes that are often much more powerful than the formal ones, who are insiders and who are outsiders, what is appropriate and inappropriate behaviour. There aren't documents written about these things. It's the way you only discover these things after you've been here for a while. And I'm not talking about this church. I'm talking about any church. A healthy church is the one whose activities below the surface are close to or identical with those below. All congregations have a system, a way of being, doing, responding that are partly shaped by the people who belong to it today, but also by generations and how they responded to crises and challenges in the past, and dare I say, how they have related to their leadership and to the denomination. Everyone, I should warn you, I've just reached the part of my sermon which is on an already printed sheet of paper, so I'm reading between the lines here. Everyone in a congregational system influences it and is influenced by the group, and people are connected into something that is much bigger and more powerful than the individuals within it. There are patterns of behaviour that seem to flow from generation to generation, even if the people have changed. There are invisible walls that can't be seen and are extremely difficult to move, but they have to move if the church is going to move on. No vision statement or structural review is enough. Without a genuine review and in most cases significant change in congregational culture, we will not see anything substantial happen. Things may look good for a while, change may appear to be embraced, but as soon as anxiety strikes, the system reflects the old patterns again. I've been a pastor now for 50 years, and I've worked with conflicted congregations for 30 of those 50 years, and this is true. This is the stuff that Jesus is talking about when he asks the man by the pool, "Do you want to get better?" When he comes to us and he says, "Do you want to get better?" He's not wanting to change the stuff up here. He's wanting to change the stuff down here. Manning Clark's father was an Anglican clergyman. This is what he said about his dad in his memoir. "Christ was a fisherman. My father fished all his life. He went fishing with me on the day he had his final stroke. Christ advised his fellow fishermen to launch out into the deep. All his life, my father spoke with rapture, with an almost spiritual exultation of the joys of catching a deep-sea leather johnny or a deep-sea blue nose. He was still talking about blue noses with the same light in his eye the last day he fished. But here was the rub. He remained all his life a coast hugger. He fished from the rocks, dropping his line straight down, never casting out into the deep, hoping the big ones he coveted would swim into the kelp attached to the rocks from which he cast his line. He was fishing from the rocks the day the darkness descended. This bloke got up and walked in, not Manning Clark's father, the man by the pool, walked into a situation he had never encountered before. It wasn't easy, but at least he kept walking. But he was walking and carrying his mat on the Sabbath. Those religious people from up there had no understanding of what was happening down here. All they could see was that one of their rules was being broken, and people who only operate up there can't handle the rules being broken. Our friend was a little confused about all of this. All he knew was that after 38 years of bedridden existence, someone had told him to get up and he was empowered to do it. He was looking for a little encouragement, but all he got was interrogation. That's what it's like sometimes up there. And then at the point of his confusion, Jesus meets him again. And this is the final thing I want to say about the good news from Jesus today. It keeps on coming. It moves beyond the superficial and meets us at our point of need. This is of great comfort to us at times to know that we are never far from his grace. But it is also unsettling for those of us who like life to be cut and dried. For every time the good news comes, the gracious presence of Jesus is accompanied by the invitation to change and move forward. Amen. I'm going to lead you now in a prayer of confession as we prepare for communion together. I'll give you a moment's silence.